Chapter 29 Seaweed 1967 Through the winter, Chase came to Kaya's shack often, usually spending one night each weekend. Even on cold, damp days, they glided through misty thickets, her collecting, him playing whimsical tunes on his harmonica. The notes floated with the fog, dissipating into the darker reaches of the lowland forests, and seemed somehow to be absorbed and memorized by the marsh, because whenever Kaya passed those channels again, she heard his music. One morning in early March, Kaya eased alone through the sea toward the village, the sky in a frumpy sweater of gray clouds. Chase's birthday was in 2 days, and she was headed to the Piggly to buy ingredients for a special supper, featuring her first caramel cake. I'd pictured setting the candle-lit cake in front of him at the table, an event that hadn't happened in the kitchen since Ma left. Several times recently, he'd said he was saving money for their house. She reckoned she'd better learn to bake. After securing her boat, as she walked along the dock toward the single file of shops, she saw Chase standing at the end talking with friends. His arms draped the shoulders of a slim blonde girl. Kaya's mind strained to make sense of this, even as her legs kept moving on their own. She'd never approached him when he was with others or in town, but short of jumping into the sea, there was no way to avoid them. Chase and his friends turned at once to look at her, and in the same instant, he dropped his arm from the girl. Kaya was dressed in white cut-off denims, setting off her long legs. A black braid fell over each breast. The group stopped talking and stared. Knowing she couldn't run up to him burned her heart with the wrongness of things. As she reached the end of the wharf where they stood, he said, "Oh, Kaya, hi." Looking from him to them, she said, "Hi, Chase." She heard him saying, "Kaya, you remember Brian and Tim, Pearl, Tina?" He rattled off a few more names until his voice faded. Turning toward Kaya, he said, "And this is Kaya Clark." Of course she didn't remember them. She'd never been introduced to them. Only knew them as tall, skinny blonde and the rest. She felt like seaweed dragged on a line, but managed to smile and say hello. This was the opportunity for which she'd waited. Here she was, standing among the friends she wanted to join. Her mind fought for words, something clever to say that might interest them. Finally, two of them greeted her coolly and turned abruptly away, the others following quickly like a school of minnows finning down the street.
"Well, so here we are," Chase said.
"I don't want to interrupt anything. I've just come for supplies, then back home."
"You're not interrupting. I just ran into them. I'll be out on Sunday, like I said."
Chase shifted his feet, fingered the shell necklace.
"I'll see you then," she said.
But he'd already turned to catch the others. She hurried toward the market, stepping around a family of mallard ducks waddling down Main Street, their bright feet surprisingly orange against the dull pavement. In the Piggly Wiggly, pushing the vision of Chase and the girl from her head, she rounded the end of the bread aisle and saw the truant lady, Mrs. Culpepper, only 4 feet away. They stood there like a rabbit and a coyote caught together in a yard fence. Kaya was now taller than the woman, and much more educated, though neither would have thought of that. After all the running, she wanted to bolt, but stood her ground and returned Mrs. Culpepper's stare. The woman nodded slightly, then moved on. Kaya found the picnic items, cheese, French bread, and cake ingredients, costing all the money she'd managed to save for the occasion. But it seemed someone else's hand lifted the items and put them into the cart. All she could see was Chase's arm resting on the girl's shoulder. She bought a local newspaper because the headlines mentioned a marine laboratory that was to open up the coast nearby. Once out of the store, head down, she scurried like a robber ferret to the pier. Back at the shack, she sat down at the kitchen table to read the article about the new lab. Sure enough, a swanky scientific facility was being developed 20 miles south of Barkley Cove near Sea Oaks. Scientists would study the ecology of the marsh, which contributed to the survival of almost half of sea life in one way or another, and Kaya turned the page to continue the story, and there loomed a large picture of Chase and a girl above an engagement announcement. Andrews Stone. Bunches of words jumped out, then sobs, and finally ragged heaves. She stood, looking at the paper from a distance, picked it up again to see. Surely she had imagined it. There they were, their faces close together, smiling. The girl, Pearl Stone, beautiful, rich-looking, with a pearl necklace and lace blouse. The one his arm had been around, always wears pearls. Touching the wall, Kaya made her way to the porch and fell on the bed, hands over her opened mouth. Then she heard a motor. Abruptly, she sat up, looked toward the lagoon, and saw Chase pulling his boat onto the shore. Quick as a mouse escaping a lidless box, she slipped out the porch door before he saw her and ran into the woods, away from the lagoon. Squatting behind palmettos, she watched as he went into the shack, calling her. He would see the article spread open on the table. In a few minutes, he came out again and walked toward the beach, figuring he would find her there. She didn't budge, even when he came back, still shouting her name. Not until he motored away did she emerge from the brambles. Moving sluggishly, she got food for the gulls and followed the sun to the beach. A strong ocean breeze pushed up the path, so that when she emerged on the beach, at least she had the wind to lean on. She called the gulls and flung large bits of French bread into the air, then swore louder and meaner than the wind. Chapter 30, The Rips, 1967. From the beach, Kaya ran to her rig and roared full throttle into the sea, headed straight for the rips. Holding her head back, she screamed, "You mean shit, some bitch!" Sloppy and confused waves jerked the bow sideways, pulling against the tiller. As always, the ocean seemed angrier than the marsh. Deeper, it had more to say. Long ago, Kaya had learned how to read ordinary currents and riptides, how to ride them out or break away by cutting perpendicular to their course. But she'd never headed straight into the deeper currents, some of them stirred by the Gulf Stream, which gushes 4 billion cubic feet of water every second, more power than all the land rivers on Earth combined, all streaming just beyond North Carolina's outstretched arms. The surge produces cruel back currents, fisted eddies, and reverse circulations that swirl with coastal riptides, birthing one of the nastiest snake pits of the planet's seas. Kaya had avoided these areas all her life, but not now. Today, she aimed straight for their throats. Anything to outrun the pain, the anger. Roiling water pushed toward her, rising under the bow and yanking the boat starboard. It heaved heavily, then righted. She was pulled into a furious rip, which carried her a quarter faster. Turning out of it seemed too risky, so she fought to steer with the current, watching for sandbars, which formed ever-shifting barriers beneath the surface. One glancing touch could flip her. Waves broke over her back, drenching her hair. Fast-moving, dark clouds streamed just above her head, blocking the sunlight and obscuring the signs of eddies and turbulence, sucking the day's heat. Still, fear eluded her. Even as she longed to feel terrified, anything to dislodge the blade jammed against her heart. Suddenly, the dark, tumbling waters of the current shifted, and the small rig spun starboard, rearing on its side. The force slammed her onto the bottom of the boat, seawater sloshing over her. Stunned, she sat in the water, bracing for another wave. Of course, she was nowhere near the actual Gulf Stream. This was the training camp, the mere playing fields for the serious sea. But to her, she had ventured into the mean and meant to ride it out, win something, kill the pain. Having lost all sense of symmetry and pattern, slate-colored waves broke from every angle. She dragged herself back into her seat and took the tiller, but didn't know where to steer. Land slung as a distant line, surfacing only now and then between white caps. Just when she glimpsed solid earth, the boat spun or tilted and she lost sight of it. She'd been so sure about riding the current, but it had grown muscular, hauling her farther into the furious, darkening sea. The clouds bunched and settled low, blocking the sun. Wet through, she shivered as her energy drained, making it difficult to steer. She'd brought no foul weather gear, no food, no water. Finally, the fear came, from a place deeper than the sea. Fear from knowing she would be alone again, probably always. A life sentence. Ugly, gasping noises passed from her throat as the boat skewed and rolled broadside, tipping dangerously with each wave. By now, 6 inches of foamy water covered the floor of the boat, burning her bare feet with its cold. How quickly the sea and clouds defeated the spring heat. Folding one arm over her chest, she tried to warm herself as she steered weakly with the other hand, not fighting the water, just moving with it. At last, the waters calmed. And although the current swept her along to its own purpose, the ocean no longer thrashed and churned. Up ahead, she saw a small elongated sandbar, maybe 100 feet long, glistening with sea and wet shells. Fighting the strong underflow, and just at the right second, Kaya jerked the tiller and turned out of the current. She steered around to the leeward side of the bar, and in the stiller waters, beached as gently as a first kiss. She stepped onto the narrow slip and sank to the sand, lay back and felt the solid land against her. She knew it wasn't chase she mourned, but a life defined by rejections. As the sky and clouds struggled overhead, she said out loud, "I have to do life alone. But I knew this. I've known a long time that people don't stay." It hadn't been a coincidence that Chase slyly mentioned marriage as bait, immediately bedded her, then dropped her for someone else. She knew from her studies that males go from one female to the next. So why had she fallen for this man? His fancy ski boat was the same as the pumped-up neck and outsized antlers of a buck deer and rut, appendages to ward off other males and attract one female after another. Yet she had fallen for the same ruse as Ma, leapfrogging sneaky fuckers. What lies had Pa told her? To what expensive restaurants had he taken her before his money gave out, and he brought her home to his real territory, a swamp shack? Perhaps love is best left as a fallow field. Speaking out loud, she recited an Amanda Hamilton poem. "I must let go now. Let you go. Love is too often the answer for staying, too seldom the reason for going. I drop the line and watch you drift away. All along, you thought the fiery current of your lover's breast pulled you to the deep.
that it was my heart tide releasing you to float adrift with seaweed.
The weak sun found space between the heavy-bottomed clouds and touched the sandbar. Kaya looked around. The current, the grand sweep of the sea, and this sand had conspired as a delicate catch net, because all around her lay the most astonishing collection of shells she'd ever seen. The angle of the bar and its gentle flow gathered the shells on the leeward side and laid them gently upon the sand without breaking them. She spotted several rare ones and many of her favorites, intact and pearly, still glistening. Moving among them, she chose the most precious and stashed them in a pile. She flipped the boat, drained the water, and lined the shells carefully along the bottom seam. Now she planned her trip back by standing tall and studying the waters. She read the sea, and having learned from the shells, would embark from the leeward side and head straight for land from here, avoiding the strongest current altogether. As she pushed off, she knew no one would ever see this sandbar again. The elements had created a brief and shifting smile of sand, angled just so. The next tide, the next current, would design another sandbar and another, but never this one. Not the one who caught her. The one who told her a thing or two. Later, wandering her beach, she recited her favorite Amanda Hamilton poem. Fading moon, follow my footsteps through light unbroken by land shadows, and share my senses that feel the cool shoulders of silence. Only you know how one side of a moment is stretched by loneliness, for miles to the other edge, and how much sky is in one breath when time slides backward from the sand. If anyone understood loneliness, the moon would. Drifting back to the predictable cycles of tadpoles and the ballet of fireflies, Kaya burrowed deeper into the wordless wilderness. Nature seemed the only stone that would not slip midstream. Chapter 31. A Book, 1968. The rusted-out mailbox, mounted on a pole paw-cut, stood at the end of the road that had no name. Kaya's only mail was bulk postings sent to all residents. She had no bills to pay, no girlfriends or old aunts to send silly sweet notes. Except for that one letter from Ma years ago, her mail was a neutral thing, and sometimes she wouldn't empty the box for weeks. But in her 22nd year, more than a year after Chase and Pearl announced their engagement, she walked the sandy lane, blistering with heat, to the mailbox every day and looked inside. Finally, one morning, she found a bulky manila envelope and slid the contents, an advance copy of The Seashells of the Eastern Seaboard by Catherine Danielle Clark, into her hands. She breathed in. No one to show it to. Sitting on her beach, she looked at every page. When Kaya had written to the publisher after Tate's initial contact and submitted more drawings, they sent her a contract by return mail. Because all her paintings and text for each shell sample had been completed for years, her editor, Mr. Robert Foster, wrote to her that the book would be published in record time and that her second on birds would follow soon after. He included an advance payment of $5,000. Pa would have tripped over his gimpy leg and spilled his poke. Now, in her hands, the final copy. Every brush stroke, every carefully thought-out color, every word of the natural histories printed in a book. There were also drawings of the creatures who live inside, how they eat, how they move, how they mate, because people forget about creatures who live in shells.
She touched the pages and remembered each shell and the story of finding it, where it lay on the beach, the season, the sunrise, a family album. Over the coming months, up and down the coasts of North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia, Virginia, Florida, and New England, gift shops and bookstores put her book in their windows or on display tables. The royalty checks would come in every 6 months, they said, and might be several $1,000s each. Sitting at the kitchen table, she drafted a letter of thanks to Tate. But as she read it over, her heart paused. A note did not seem enough. Because of his kindness, her love of the marsh could now be her life's work. Her life. Every feather, shell, or insect she collected could be shared with others, and no longer would she have to dig through mud for her supper. Might not have to eat grits every day. Jumpin' had told her Tate was working as an ecologist at the new institute and laboratory near Sea Oaks, which had assigned him a spiffed-up research boat. At times, she'd seen him in the distance, but steered clear. She added a postscript to the note. If you're near my place sometime, stop by. I'd like to give you a copy of the book. And addressed it to him at the lab. The next week, she hired a fix-it man, Jerry, who put in running water, a water heater, and a full bathroom with a clawfoot tub in the back bedroom. He set a sink in a cabinet topped with tiles and installed a flush toilet. Electricity was brought in, and Jerry put in a range and new refrigerator. Kaya insisted on keeping the old wood stove, firewood piled next to it, because it heated the shack. But mostly because it had baked 1,000 biscuits from her mother's heart. What if Ma came back and her stove was gone? He made kitchen cabinets of heart pine, hung a new front door, a new screen on the porch, and made shelves for her specimens from floor to ceiling. She ordered a sofa, chairs, beds, mattresses, and rugs from Sears Roebuck, but kept the old kitchen table. And now she had a real closet to store a few mementos, a little scrap closet of her fallen away family. As before, the shack stood unpainted on the outside, the weathered pine boards and tin roof rich in gray and rust colors, brushed by Spanish moss from the overhanging oak. Less rickety, but still woven into the weft of the marsh. Kaya continued sleeping on the porch, except in the coldest of winter. But now she had a bed. One morning, Jumpin' told Kaya developers were coming to the area with big plans to drain the murky swamp and build hotels. Now and then, over the last year, she'd seen large machines cutting entire stands of oaks in a week, then digging channels to dry the marsh. When finished, they moved on to new spots, leaving tracks of thirst and hardpan behind. Apparently, they had not read Aldo Leopold's book. A poem by Amanda Hamilton said it clearly. Child to child, eye to eye, we grew as one, sharing souls, wing by wing, leaf by leaf. You left this world. You died before the child. My friend, the wild. Kaya didn't know if her family owned the land or just squatted it, as had most marsh people for four centuries. Over the years, searching for clues of Ma's whereabouts, she'd read every scrap of paper in the shack and had never seen anything like a deed. As soon as she got home from Jumpin's, she wrapped the old Bible in a cloth and took it to the Bartley Cove courthouse. The county clerk, a white-haired man with an enormous forehead and tiny shoulders, brought out a large leather volume of records, some maps, and a few aerial photographs, which he spread on the counter. Running her finger across the map, Kaya pointed out her lagoon and outlined the rough boundaries of what she thought of as her land. The clerk checked the reference number
and searched for the deed in an old wooden filing cabinet.
Yep, here it is, he said. It were surveyed proper and bought up in 1897 by a Mr. Napier Clark.
That's my grandpa, Kaya said. She thumbed through the thin pages of the Bible, and there, in the records of births and deaths, was one Napier Murphy Clark. Such a grand name. The same as her brother's. She told the clerk her pa was dead, which he probably was.
It's ne'er been sold, so yessiree, Bobtail, I reckon it belongs to you. But I'm afraid to tell you, there's some back taxes, Miss Clark, and to keep the land, you gotta pay 'em. In fact, ma'am, the way the law reads, whoever comes along and pays off them back taxes owns the land even if they don't got no deed.
How much?
Kaya had not opened a bank account, and all the cash she owned after the improvements to her house, some $3,000, was right in her knapsack. But they must be talking 40 years of back taxes, thousands and thousands of dollars.
Well, let's looky here. It's listed as wasteland category, so taxes for most of them years was about $5. Let's see here. I gotta calculate it.
He stepped over to a fat and clunky adding machine, punched in numbers, and after every entry, pulled back the crank handle, which made a churning sound as if it were actually summing up.
Looks like it'll be about $800 total. Put the land free and clear.
Kaya walked out of the courthouse with a full deed in her name for 310 acres of lush lagoons, sparkling marsh, oak forests, and a long private beach on the North Carolina coastline. Wasteland category, murky swamp. Pulling back into her lagoon at dusk, she had a talk with the heron.
It's all right. That spot's yourn.
The next noon, there was a note from Tate in her mailbox, which seemed strange and somehow formal, since he'd only ever left messages for her on the feather stump. He thanked her for the invitation to stop by her place for a copy of her book, and added that he'd be there that very afternoon. Carrying one of the 6 copies of her new book the publishers had given her, she waited on the old reading log. In about 20 minutes, she heard the sound of Tate's old boat chugging up the channel and stood. As he eased into view from the undergrowth, they waved and smiled softly, both guarded. The last time he'd pulled in here, she'd hurled rocks in his face. After tying up, Tate stepped up to her.
Kaya, your book is a wonder.
He leaned slightly forward as if to hug her, but the hardened rinds of her heart held her back. Instead, she handed him the book.
Here, Tate, this is for you.
Thank you, Kaya,
he said as he opened it and paged through. He didn't mention that, of course, he'd already bought one at the Sea Oaks bookshelf and marveled at every page.
Nothing like this has ever been published. I'm sure this is just a beginning for you.
She simply bowed her head and smiled slightly. Then, turning to the title page, he said,
Oh, you haven't signed it. You have to inscribe it for me. Please.
She jerked her head up at him.
Had not thought of that.
What words could she possibly write to Tate? He took a pen from his jeans pocket and handed it to her. She took it, and after a few seconds wrote,
To the Feather Boy, thank you, from the Marsh Girl.
Tate read the words, then turned away, staring far across the marsh because he couldn't hold her. Finally, he lifted her hand and squeezed it.
Thank you, Kaya.
It was you, Tate. She said, and then thought, it was always you.
One side of her heart longing, the other shielding. He stood for a minute, a and when she didn't say more, he turned to go. But as he got into his boat, he said,
Kaya, when you see me out in the marsh, please don't hide in the grass like a spotted fawn. Just call out to me and we can do some exploring together. Okay?
All right.
Thanks again for the book.
Goodbye, Tate.
She watched until he disappeared in the thicket and then said,
I could have at least invited him in for tea.
That wouldn't hurt anything. I could be his friend.
Then, with rare pride, she thought of her book.
I could be his colleague.
An hour after Tate left, Kaya motored to Jumpin's Wharf, another copy of her book tucked in her knapsack. As she approached, she saw him leaning against the wall of his weathered shop. He stood and waved to her, but she did not wave back. Knowing something was different, he waited silently as she tied up. She stepped up to him, lifted his hand, and put the book in his palm. At first, he didn't understand, but she pointed to her name and said,
I'm okay now, Jumpin'.
Thank you, and thank Mabel for all you did for me.
He stared at her. In another time and place, an old black man and a young white woman might have hugged, but not there, not then. She covered his hand with hers, turned, and motored away. It was the first time she'd seen him speechless. She kept on buying gas and supplies from him, but never accepted a handout from them again. And each time she came to his wharf, she saw her book propped up in the tiny window for all to see, as a father would have shown it. Chapter 32, Alibi, 1969. Low, dark clouds raced over a steel sea toward Barkley Cove. The wind hit first, rattling windows and hurling waves over the wharf. Boats tied to the dock bobbed up and down like toys, as men in yellow slickers tied this line or that, securing. Then sideways rain slammed the village, obscuring everything except the odd yellow form moving about in the grayness. The wind whistled through the sheriff's window, and he raised his voice.
So, Joe, you had something to tell me?
Sure do. I find out where Miss Clark will claim she was the night Chase died.
What? Did you finally catch up to her?
You kidding? She's slipperier than a damn eel. Gets gone every time I get near. So I drove over to Jumpin's Marina this morning to see if he knew when she'd be coming next. Like everybody else, she has to go there for gas, so I figured I'd catch her up sooner or later. You won't believe what I found out.
Let's have it.
I got two reliable sources say she was out of town that night.
What?
Who? She never goes out of town. And even if she did, who'd know about it? You remember Tate Walker? Dr. Walker now? Works out at the new ecology lab.
Yeah, I know him. His dad's a shrimper. Scupper Walker.
Well, Tate says he knew Kaya, he calls her Kaya, quite well when they were younger.
Oh?
Not like that. They were just kids. He taught her to read, apparently.
He tell you this himself?
Yep. He was there at Jumpin's. I was asking Jumpin' if he knew where or how I could ask the Marsh girl some questions. He said he didn't know from one minute to the next when he'd see her.
Jumpin's always been good to her. Doubt if he'll tell us much.
Well, I asked him if by any chance he knew what she was doing the night Chase died. And he said that, as a matter of fact, he did. That she'd come to his place the second morning after Chase died, and that he was the very one who told her he was dead. He said she'd been in Greenville for two nights, including the night Chase died.
Greenville?
That's what he said. And then Tate, who'd been standing there all that time, he piped in and said, yeah, she'd been in Greenville, that he was the one who told her how to buy the bus ticket. Well, that is some news, Sheriff Jackson said, and very convenient that they were both standing there with the same story. Why would she go over to Greenville? Tate said that a publishing company, you know, she's gone and written a book on shells and one of seabirds. Well, they paid her expenses to go over there and meet him. Hard to imagine fancy publishing people wanting to meet her. I guess it'll be pretty easy to check out. What did Tate say about teaching her to read? I asked him how he knew her. He said he used to go out near her place to fish, and when he found out she couldn't read, he taught her. That's so, Joe said. Anyway, this changes everything. She does have an alibi, a good one. I'd say being in Greenville's a pretty good alibi. Yeah, on the surface. You know what they say about good alibis? And we got that shrimper saying he saw her boating directly toward the fire tower the very night Chase fell off it. He could have been wrong. It was dark. No moon until after 2 a.m. Maybe she was in Greenville and he saw somebody else out there in a boat looks like hers. Well, like I said, this supposed trip to Greenville should be easy to check out.
The storm abated into a whine and drizzle. Still, instead of walking to the diner, the two lawmen sent a runner for a takeout of chicken and dumplings, butter beans, summer squash casserole, cane syrup, and biscuits. Right after lunch, a knock sounded on the sheriff's door. Miss Pansy Price opened it and stepped inside. Joe and Ed stood. Her turban hat glistened a rose color.
Afternoon, Miss Pansy.
Both nodded. Good afternoon, Ed. Joe, may I have a seat? I won't take long. I believe I have important information concerning the case.
Yes, of course. Sit down, please.
The two men sat as soon as Miss Pansy settled like a fair-sized hen into the chair, tucking feathers here and there, her pocketbook perching on her lap like a prized egg. The sheriff, continuing, couldn't resist.
And what case would that be, Miss Pansy?
Oh, for heaven's sake, Ed, you know what case. Who murdered Chase Andrews? That case.
We don't know if he was murdered, Miss Pansy. All right. Now, what do you have for us?
As you know, I'm employed at Cress's. She never lowered her standing by referring to the entire name, Cress's Five and Dime. She waited for the sheriff to acknowledge her comment with a nod, even though they all knew she'd worked there since she sold toy soldiers to him as a boy, and then continued.
I believe the Marsh girl is a suspect. Is that correct?
Who told you that?
Oh, lots of people are convinced, but Patty Love's the main source.
I see.
Well, from Cress's, me and some other employees saw the Marsh girl get on and off the bus on days that would have put her out of town the night Chase died. I can testify to those dates and times.
That so?
Joe and Ed exchanged glances.
What are the dates and times?
Miss Pansy sat straighter in her chair.
She left on the 2:30 p.m. bus on October 28th and returned at 1:16 on the 30th.
You said others saw her, too?
Yes. I can get a list if you like.
That won't be necessary. We'll come over to the Five and Dime if we want statements. Thank you, Miss Pansy.
The sheriff stood. So Miss Pansy and Ed did as well. She moved toward the door.
Well, thank you for your time. As you said, you know where to find me.
They said goodbyes. Joe sat back down.
Well, there it is. Confirms what Tate and Jumpin said. She was in Greenville that night. Or leastwise, she got on a bus and went somewheres.
The sheriff blew out a long breath.
Appears so. But I reckon if somebody can bus over to Greenville by day, they can bus back here at night, do their business, bus back to Greenville. Nobody the wiser. I guess. Seems a bit of a stretch. Go get the bus schedules. We'll see if the times work out. If a return trip is possible in one night.
Before Joe stepped out, Ed continued.
Could be she wanted to be seen out there in broad daylight getting on and off of buses. When you think about it, she had to do something out of the ordinary for an alibi. To claim that she'd been alone in her shack the night Chase died, as she usually is, would be no alibi at all. Zip. So she planned up something that lots of people would see her do, making a great alibi right in front of all those folks on Main Street. Brilliant.
Well, yeah, that's a good point. Anyhow, we don't have to play gumshoe anymore. We can sit right here drinking coffee and let the ladies of this town waltz in and out of here with all the goods. I'll go get the bus schedules.
Joe returned 15 minutes later.
Well, you're right, he said. See here, it would be possible to bus from Greenville to Barkley Cove and then back again all in one night. Easy, really. Yeah. Plenty of time between the two buses to push somebody off the fire tower. I say we get a warrant.
Chapter 33 The Scar, 1968. In the winter of 1968, Kaya sat at her kitchen table one morning, sweeping orange and pink watercolors across paper, creating the plump form of a mushroom. She had finished her book on seabirds and now worked on a guide to mushrooms. Already had plans for another on butterflies and moths. Black-eyed peas, red onions, and salt ham boiled in the old dented pot on the wood stove, which she still preferred to the new range, especially in winter. The tin roof sang under a light rain. Then, suddenly the sounds of a truck laboring through sand came down her lane, rumbling louder than the roof. Panic rising, she stepped to the window and saw a red pickup maneuvering the muddy ruts. Kaya's first thought was to run, but the truck was already pulling up to the porch. Hunched down below the windowsill, she watched a man in a gray-green military uniform step out. He just stood there. Truck door ajar, looking through the woods, down the path toward the lagoon. Then, closing the door softly, he jogged through the rain to the porch door and knocked. She cussed. He was probably lost, would ask directions and go on, but she didn't want to deal with him. She could hide here in the kitchen, hope he went away. But she heard him call,
"Yo, anybody home? Hello?"
Annoyed yet curious, she walked through the newly furnished sitting room to the porch. The stranger, tall with dark hair, stood on the front step holding the screen door open, 5 feet from her. His uniform seemed stiff enough to stand on its own, as if it were holding him together. The breast of his jacket was covered with colorful rectangular medals. But most eye-catching of all was a jagged red scar that cut his face in half from his left ear to the top of his lips. Kaya gasped. In an instant, she returned to the Easter Sunday about 6 months before Ma left for good. Singing Rock of Ages, she and Ma walked arm in arm through the sitting room to the kitchen and gathered up the brilliantly colored eggs they had painted the night before. The other kids were out fishing, so she and Ma had time to hide the eggs, then get the chicken and biscuits into the oven.
The brothers and sisters were too old to hunt for treats, but they would run around searching, pretending not to find them, then holding each discovered treasure high in the air, laughing. Ma and Kaya were leaving the kitchen with their baskets of eggs and chocolate bunnies from the Five and Dime, just as Pa rounded the corner from the hall. Yanking Kaya's Easter bonnet from her head and waving it around, he screamed at Ma,
"Where you get the money for these fancy things? Bonnets and shiny leather shoes? Them prissy eggs and chocolate bunnies? Say, where?"
"Come on, Jake. Please hush. It's Easter. This is for the kids."
He shoved Ma backward.
"You out whoring, that's what. That how you get the money? Tell me now."
He grabbed Ma by the arms and shook her so hard, her face seemed to rattle around her eyes, which stayed very still and wide open. Eggs tumbled from the basket and rolled in wobbly pastels across the floor.
"Pa, please stop!"
Kaya cried out, then sobbed. He lifted his hand and slapped Kaya hard across the cheek.
"Shut up, you prissy pot crybaby. Get that silly-looking dress and fancy shoes off you. Them's whoring clothes."
She ducked down, holding her face, chasing after Ma's hand-painted eggs.
"I'm talking to you, woman. Where you getting your money?"
He lifted the iron fire poker from the corner and moved toward Ma. Kaya screamed as loud as she could and grabbed at Pa's arm as he slammed the poker across Ma's chest. Blood popped out on the flowery sundress like red polka dots. Then a big body moved down the hall, and Kaya looked up to see Jody tackle Pa from behind, sending them both sprawling across the floor. Her brother got between Ma and Pa and hollered for Kaya and Ma to run, and they did. But before she turned, Kaya saw Pa raise the poker and whack Jody across the face, his jaw twisting grossly, blood spewing. The scene played out in her mind now in a flash. Her brother crumbling onto the floor, lying among purple-pink eggs and chocolate bunnies. She and Ma running through palmettos, hiding in brush. Her dress bloody, Ma kept saying it was fine, the eggs wouldn't break, and they could still cook the chicken. Kaya didn't understand why they stayed hidden there. She was sure her brother was dying, needed their help, but she was too afraid to move. They waited for a long time and then snuck back, looking through the windows to make sure Pa was gone. Jody lay cold on the floor, blood pooled around him, and Kaya cried that he was dead. But Ma aroused him and moved him to the sofa, where she stitched up his face with her sewing needle. When all was quiet, Kaya snatched her bonnet from the floor and ran fast through the woods and threw it with all her might into the sawgrass. Now, she looked into the eyes of the stranger standing on her porch and said,
"Jody."
He smiled, the scar going crooked, and replied,
"Kaya, I hoped you'd be here."
They stared, each searching for the other in older eyes. Jody couldn't know he had been with her all these years, that scores of times he had shown her the way through the marsh, taught her over and over about herons and fireflies. More than anyone else, she had wanted to see Jody or Ma again. Her heart had erased the scar and all the pain in that package. No wonder her mind buried the scene. No wonder Ma had left, hit by a poker across the chest. Kaya saw those rubbed-out stains on the flowered sundress as blood again. He wanted to hug her, fold her into his arms. But as he moved toward her, she hung her head low to the side in profound shyness and backed up. So he simply stepped onto the porch.
"Come in,"
she said, and led him into the small living room, chock full with her specimens.
"Oh," he said. "Yes, then. I saw your book, Kaya. I didn't know for sure if it was you, but yes,
Now I can see it was. It's amazing.
He walked around looking at her collections, also examining the room with its new furniture, glancing down the halls to the bedrooms, not wanting to snoop, but taking it all in. Do you want coffee? Tea? She didn't know if he'd come for a visit or to stay. What did he want after all these years?
Coffee would be great. Thank you.
In the kitchen, he recognized the old wood stove next to the new gas range and refrigerator. He ran his hand over the old kitchen table, which she had kept as it was, with all its peeling paint history. She poured the coffee in mugs, and they sat.
You're a soldier, then?
Two tours in Nam. I'm staying in the army for a few more months. They've been good to me. Paid for my college degree. Mechanical engineering. Georgia Tech. Least I can do is stay in a while.
Georgia wasn't all that far away. He could have visited sooner. But he was here now.
You all left, she said. Pa stayed a while after you. But then he went too.
I don't know where. Don't know if he's alive or not. You've been here by yourself since then?
Yes.
Kaya, I shouldn't have left you with that monster. I've ached, felt terrible about it for years. I was a coward, a stupid coward. These damned medals don't mean a thing.
He swiped at his chest.
I left you, a little girl, alone to survive in a swamp with a madman. I don't expect you to forgive me ever.
Jody, it's okay. You were just a kid yourself. What could you do?
I could have come back when I was older. At first, it was day-to-day survival on the back streets of Atlanta. He sneered. I left here with 75 cents in my pocket. Stole it from the money Pa left in the kitchen. Took it, knowing it would leave you short. I scraped by on odd jobs till the army took me in. After training, it was straight to war. When I got home, so much time had passed, I figured you were long gone, run away yourself. That's the reason I didn't write. I think I signed up to go back as a kind of self-punishment. What I deserved for leaving you. Then, after I graduated from Tech a couple of months ago, I saw your book in a shop. Catherine Danielle Clark. My heart just broke and leapt for joy all at once. I had to find you. Figured I'd start here and track you down.
Well, here we are, then.
She smiled for the first time. His eyes were the same as they had been. Faces change with life's toll, but eyes remain a window to what was, and she could see him there.
Jody, I'm so sorry you worried about leaving me. Not once did I blame you. We were the victims, not the guilty.
He smiled.
Thank you, Kaya.
Tears welled, and they both looked away. She hesitated, then said,
This may be hard to believe, but for a while, Pa was good to me.
He drank less, taught me to fish, and we went out in the boat a lot, all over the marsh. But then, of course, he went back to drinking and left me to fend for myself.
Jody nodded.
Yeah, I saw that side of him a few times. But he always went back to the bottle. He told me once it had something to do with the war. I've been to war myself and seen things that could drive a man to drink. But he shouldn't have taken it out on his wife, his own kids.
What about Ma? The others?
She asked.
Did you ever hear from them? Know where they went?
I don't know a thing about Murph, Mandy, or Missy. I wouldn't know them if I passed them in the street. By now, I suppose they've scattered with the wind, But Ma... Well, Kaya, that's another reason I wanted to find you. There is some news of her.
Some news? What? Tell me.
Chills flowed from Kaya's arms to her fingertips.
Kaya, it's not good. I only found out last week. Ma died 2 years ago.
She bent at the waist, holding her face in her hands. Soft groans came from her throat.
Jody tried to hold her, but she moved away from him.
Jody continued. Ma had a sister, Rosemary, who tried to track us down through the Red Cross when Ma died, but they couldn't find us. Then, a couple of months ago, they found me through the army and put me in touch with Rosemary.
In hoarse tones, Kaya mumbled, Ma was alive until 2 years ago. I've been waiting all these years for her to walk down the lane.
She stood and held on to the sink.
Why didn't she come back? Why didn't somebody tell me where she was? And now it's too late.
Jody went to her, and even though she tried to turn away, he put his arms around her.
I'm sorry, Kaya. Come sit down. I'll tell you what Rosemary said.
He waited for her, then said,
Ma was ill from a major breakdown when she left us and went to New Orleans. That's where she grew up. She was mentally and physically ill. I remember New Orleans a little bit. I guess I was 5 when we left. All I remember is a nice house, big windows overlooking a garden. But once we moved here, Pa wouldn't let any of us talk about New Orleans, our grandparents, or any of it. So it was all wiped away.
Kaya nodded.
I never knew.
Jody continued.
Rosemary said their parents had been against Ma's marriage to Pa from the start, but Ma went off to North Carolina with her husband, not a penny to their names. Eventually, Ma began writing to Rosemary and told her of her circumstances, living in a swamp shack with a drunk man who beat her and her children. Then one day, years later, Ma showed up. She had on those fake alligator heels that she cherished, hadn't bathed or combed her hair in days. For months, Ma was mute, didn't speak one word. She stayed in her old room in her parents' home, barely eating. Of course, they had doctors come out, but no one could help her. Ma's father contacted the sheriff in Barkley Cove to ask if Ma's children were all right, but his office said they didn't even try to keep track of the Marsh people.
Kaya sniffed now and then.
Finally, almost a year later, Ma became hysterical and told Rosemary she remembered she had left her children. Rosemary helped her write a letter to Pa asking if she could come get us and bring us to live with her in New Orleans. He wrote back that if she returned or contacted any of us, he would beat us unrecognizable. She knew he was capable of such a thing.
The letter in the blue envelope. Ma had asked for her, for all of them. Ma had wanted to see her.
But the outcome of the letter had been vastly different. The words had enraged Pa and sent him back to drinking, and then Kaya had lost him as well. She didn't mention to Jody that she still kept the letter's ashes in a little jar.
Rosemary said Ma never made friends, never dined with the family or interacted with anybody. She allowed herself no life, no pleasure. After a while, she started talking more, and all she talked about was her children. Rosemary said, Ma loved us all her life, but was frozen in some horrible place of believing that we'd be harmed if she returned and abandoned if she didn't. She didn't leave us to have a fling. She'd been driven to madness and barely knew she'd left.
Kaya asked,
How did she die?
She had leukemia. Rosemary said it was possibly treatable, but she refused all medication. She just became weaker and weaker and slipped away 2 years ago. Rosemary said she died much as she had lived, in darkness, in silence.
Jody and Kaya sat still. Kaya thought of the poem by Galway Kinnell that Ma had underlined in her book. I have to say, I am relieved it is over. At the end, I could feel only pity for that urge toward more life. Goodbye. Jody stood.
Come with me, Kaya. I want to show you something.
He led her outside to his pickup and they climbed into the back. Carefully, he removed a tarp and opened a large cardboard box, and one by one, pulled out and unwrapped oil paintings. He stood them up around the bed of the truck. One was of three young girls, Kaya and her sisters, squatting by the lagoon, watching dragonflies. Another of Jody and their brother, holding up a string of fish.
I brought them in case you were still here. Rosemary sent these to me. She said that for years, day and night, Ma painted us.
One painting showed all five children as if they were watching the artist. Kaya stared into the eyes of her sisters and brothers, looking back at her. In a whisper, she asked,
Who's who?
What?
There were never any photographs. I don't know them. Who's who?
Oh. He couldn't breathe, then finally said, Well, this is Missy, the oldest. Then Murph, Mandy. Of course, this little cutie is me, and that's you.
He gave her time, then said,
Look at this one.
Before him was an astonishingly colorful oil of two children squatting in swirls of green grass and wildflowers. The girl was only a toddler, perhaps 3 years old, her straight black hair falling over her shoulders. The boy, a bit older with golden curls, pointed to a monarch butterfly, its black and yellow wings spread across a daisy. His hand was on the girl's arm.
I think that's Tate Walker, Jody said. And you?
I think you're right. It looks like him.
Why would Ma paint Tate? He used to come around quite a bit. Fish with me. He was always showing you insects and stuff.
Why don't I remember that?
You were very young. One afternoon, Tate boated into our lagoon where Pa was pulling on his poke, really drunk. You were waiting and Pa was supposed to be watching you. Suddenly, for no reason at all, Pa grabbed you by your arms and shook you so hard your head was thrown back. Then he dropped you in the mud and started laughing. Tate jumped out of the boat and ran up to you. He was only 7 or 8 years old, but he shouted at Pa. Of course, Pa smacked him and screamed at him to get off his land, never come back or he'd shoot him. By this time, we'd all run down to see what was happening. Even with Pa ranting and raving, Tate picked you up and handed you to Ma. He made sure you were all right before he left. We still went fishing some after that, but he never came back to our place again.
Not until he led me home that first time I took the boat into the marsh, Kaya thought.
She looked at the painting, so pastel, so peaceful. Somehow, Ma's mind had pulled beauty from lunacy. Anyone looking at these portraits would think they portrayed the happiest of families, living on a seashore, playing in sunshine. Jody and Kaya sat on the rim of the truck bed, still looking quietly at the paintings. He continued.
Ma was isolated and alone. Under those circumstances, people behave differently.
Kaya made a soft groan.
Please don't talk to me about isolation.
No one has to tell me how it changes a person. I have lived it.
I am isolation,
Kaya whispered with a slight edge.
I forgive Ma for leaving, but I don't understand why she didn't come back, why she abandoned me. You probably don't remember, but after she walked away, you told me that a she-fox will sometimes leave her kits if she's starving or under some other extreme stress. The kits die, as they probably would have anyway, but the vixen lives to breed again when conditions are better, when she can raise a new litter to maturity. I've read a lot about this since. In nature, out yonder where the crawdads sing, these ruthless-seeming behaviors actually increase the mother's number of young over her lifetime, and thus her genes for abandoning offspring in times of stress are passed on to the next generation, and on and on. It happens in humans, too. Some behaviors that seem harsh to us now ensured the survival of early man in whatever swamp he was in at the time. Without them, we wouldn't be here. We still store those instincts in our genes, and they express themselves when certain circumstances prevail. Some parts of us will always be what we were, what we had to be to survive way back yonder. Maybe some primitive urge, some ancient genes not appropriate anymore, drove Ma to leave us because of the stress, the horror, and real danger of living with Pa. That doesn't make it right. She should have chosen to stay. But knowing that these tendencies are in our biological blueprints might help one forgive even a failed mother. That may explain her leaving, but I still don't see why she didn't come back, why she didn't even write to me. She could have written letter after letter, year after year, until one finally got to me.
I guess some things can't be explained, only forgiven or not. I don't know the answer. Maybe there isn't one. I'm sorry to bring you this bad news.
I've had no family, no news of family for most of my life. Now, within a few minutes, I've found a brother and lost my mother.
I'm so sorry, Kaya.
Don't be. Actually, I lost Ma years ago. And now you're back, Jody. I can't tell you how much I wanted to see you again. This is one of the happiest and yet saddest days of my life.
She touched his arm with her fingers, and he already knew her enough to know this was rare. They walked back into the shack, and he looked around at the new things, the freshly painted walls, the handcrafted kitchen cabinets.
How'd you manage, Kaya? Before your book, how'd you get money, food?
Oh, that's a long, boring story. Mostly I sold mussels, oysters, and smoked fish to Jumpin'.
Jody threw his head back and laughed out loud.
Jumpin'? I haven't thought about him for years. Is he still around?
Kaya didn't laugh.
Jumpin' has been my best friend. For years, my only friend. My only family, unless you count herring gulls.
Jody turned serious.
Didn't you have friends in school?
I only went to school one day in my life, she chuckled. The kids laughed at me, so I never went back. Spent weeks outsmarting the truant officers, which after all the things you'd taught me wasn't very hard.
He looked astonished.
How did you learn to read? To write your book.
Actually, it was Tate Walker who taught me to read.
You ever see him anymore?
Now and then.
She stood, faced the stove.
More coffee?
Jody felt the lonely life hanging in her kitchen. It was there in the tiny supply of onions in the vegetable basket, the single plate drying in the rack. The cornbread wrapped carefully in a tea towel, the way an old widow might do it.
I've had plenty, thanks. But what about a ride around the marsh? He asked.
Of course. You won't believe it. I have a new motor, but still use that same old boat.
The sun had broken up the clouds and shone bright and warm for a winter day. As she steered them through narrow channels and glassy estuaries, he exclaimed at a remembered snag, the same as it had been, and a beaver lodge still piled in the exact spot. They laughed when they came to the lagoon where Ma, Kaya, and their sisters had grounded the boat in mud. Back at the shack, she put together a picnic, which they ate on the beach with the gulls.
"I was so young when they all left," she said. "Tell me about the others."
So he told her stories of their older brother, Murph, who carried her around on his shoulders through the woods. "You used to laugh the whole time. He would jog and turn circles with you way up there. And one time you laughed so hard, you wet your pants right on his neck."
"Oh, no, I didn't."
Kaya leaned back, laughing. "Yes, you did. He squealed some, but he kept on going. Ran right into the lagoon until he was underwater, and you still riding his shoulders. We were all watching, Ma, Missy, Mandy, and me, and laughed till we cried. Ma had to sit right down on the ground, she was laughing so hard." Her mind invented pictures to go with the stories. Family scraps and shreds Kaya never thought she'd have. Jody continued. "It was Missy who started feeding the gulls."
"What? Really? I thought I started it on my own after everybody left."
"No, she fed the gulls every day she could get away with it. She gave them all names. She called one Big Red, I remember that. You know, after that red spot on their bills."
"It's not the same bird, of course. I've gone through a few generations of Big Reds myself, but there, the one on the left, that's Big Red today."
She tried to connect with the sister who had given her the gulls, but all she could see was the face in the painting, which was more than she'd had before. The red spot on a herring gull's bill, Kaya knew, was more than decoration. Only when the chicks pecked at the spot with their bills would the parent release the captured food for them. If the red spot was obscured so that the chicks didn't tap it, the parent wouldn't feed them and they would die. Even in nature, parenthood is a thinner line than one might think. They sat for a moment. Then Kaya said,
"I just don't remember much about it at all."
"You're lucky, then. Just keep it that way." They sat there like that, quietly, not remembering. She cooked a southern supper as Ma would have. Black-eyed peas with red onions, fried ham, cornbread with cracklin', butter beans cooked in butter and milk. Blackberry cobbler with hard cream with some bourbon Jody brought. As they ate, he told her he would like to stay a few days if that was okay, and she said he was welcome as long as he liked.
"This is your land now, Kaya. You earned it.
I'm stationed at Fort Benning for a while yet, so I can't stay long. After that, I'll probably get a job in Atlanta so we can stay in touch. I'd like to see you as often as I can get up here. Knowing you're okay is all I ever wanted in my life."
"I'd like that, Jody. Please come whenever you can."
The next evening, as they sat on the beach, wave tips tickling their bare toes, Kaya chatted in unusual fashion, and Tate seemed to be in every paragraph. There was the time he showed her the way home when she, as a little girl, was lost in the marsh, or the first poem Tate read to her. She talked about the feather game and how he taught her to read, how he was a scientist at the lab now. He was her first love, but he had dropped her when he went to college, left her waiting on the lagoon shore. So it had ended.
"How long ago was that?" Jody asked.
"About 7 years, I guess, when he first went to Chapel Hill."
"Did you ever see him again?"
"He came back to apologize. Said he still loved me. He was the one who suggested I publish reference books. It's nice to see him now and then in the marsh, but I'd never get involved again. He can't be trusted.
Kaya, that was 7 years ago. He was just a boy. First time away from home, hundreds of pretty girls around. If he came back and apologized and says he loves you, maybe you should cut him a little slack.
Most men go from one female to the next. The unworthy ones strut about, pulling you in with falsehoods, which is probably why Ma fell for a man like Pa. Tate wasn't the only guy who left me. Chase Andrews even talked to me about marriage, but he married someone else. Didn't even tell me. I read it in the paper.
I'm so sorry. I am. But Kaya, it's not just guys who are unfaithful. I've been duped, dropped, run over a few times myself. Let's face it, a lot of times love doesn't work out. Yet even when it fails, it connects you to others, and in the end, that is all you have, the connections.
Look at us. You and I have each other now, and just think, if I have kids and you have kids, well, that's a whole new string of connections, and on it goes. Kaya, if you love Tate, take a chance. Kaya thought of Ma's painting of Tate and herself as children, their heads close together, surrounded by pastel flowers and butterflies. Maybe a message from Ma after all. On the third morning of Jody's visit, they unpacked Ma's paintings, all but one, which Jody kept, and hung some on the walls. The shack took on a different light, as though more windows had opened up. She stood back and stared at them. A miracle to have some of Ma's paintings back on the walls, pulled from the fire. Then Kaya walked Jody out to his pickup and gave him a bag lunch she'd made for his trip. They both looked through the trees, down the lane, everywhere except into each other's eyes. Finally, he said,
I better get going, but here's my address and phone number.
As he held out a scrap of notepaper, she stopped breathing, and with her left hand, held herself steady on the truck as she took the paper with her right. Such a simple thing, the address of a brother on a slip of paper. Such an astonishing thing, a family she could find, a number she could call and he would answer. She choked on her own throat as he pulled her to him. And finally, after a lifetime, she sagged against him and wept.
I never thought I'd see you again. I thought you were gone forever.
I'll always be here. I promise. Whenever I move, I'll send my new address. If you ever need me, you write or call, you hear?
I will. And come back for a visit whenever you can.
Kaya, go find Tate. He's a good man.
He waved from the truck window all the way down the lane as she watched, crying and laughing all at once. And when he turned onto the track, she could see his red pickup through the holes of the forest where a white scarf had once trailed away, his long arm waving until he was gone. Chapter 34. Search the Shack. 1969.
Well, again, she's not here,
Joe said, knocking on the frame of Kaya's screen door. Ed stood on the brick and board steps, cupping his hands on the mesh to see inside. Enormous limbs of the oak, hung with long strands of Spanish moss, cast shadows on the weathered boards and pointy roof of the shack. Only gray patches of sky blinked through the late November morning.
Of course she's not here. It doesn't matter. We have a search warrant. Just go on in. Bet it isn't locked.
Joe opened the door, calling out,
Anybody home? Sheriff here.
Inside, they stared at the shelves of her menagerie.
Ed, look at all this stuff. It keeps going in the next room yonder, and on down the hall. Looks like she's a bit off her rocker, crazy as a three-eyed rat. Maybe, but apparently she's quite an expert on the marsh. You know she published those books. Let's get busy. Okay, here are the things to look for.
The sheriff read out loud from a short list.
Articles of red wool clothing that might match the red fibers found on Chase's jacket. A diary, calendar, or notes, something that might mention places and times of her whereabouts. The shell necklace, or stubs from those night buses. And let's not mess up her stuff. No reason to do that. We can look under, around everything. Don't need to ruin any of this. Yeah, I hear ya. Almost like a shrine in here. Half of me's impressed. The other half's got the heebie-jeebies. It's going to be tedious, that's for sure,
the sheriff said as he carefully looked behind a row of bird nests.
I'll start back in her bedroom.
The man worked silently, pushing clothes around in drawers, poking in closet corners, shifting jars of snake skins and shark's teeth in search of evidence. After 10 minutes, Joe called,
Come look at this.
As Ed entered the porch, Joe said,
Did you know that female birds only got one ovary? What are you talking about? See, these drawings and notes show that female birds only got one ovary. Dang it, Joe. We're not here for a biology lesson. Get back to work.
Wait a second. Look here. This is a male peacock feather, and the note says that over eons of time, the male's feathers got larger and larger to attract females, till the point the males can barely lift off the ground. Can't hardly fly anymore.
Are you finished? We have a job to do.
Well, it's very interesting.
Ed walked from the room.
Get to work, man.
10 minutes later, Joe called out again. As Ed walked out of the small bedroom toward the sitting room, he said,
Let me guess. You found a stuffed mouse with three eyes.
There was no reply. But when Ed walked into the room, Joe held up a red wool hat.
Where do you find that?
Right here, hanging on this row of hooks with these coats, other hats, and stuff.
In the open, like that.
Right here, like I said.
From his pocket, Ed pulled out the plastic bag containing the red fibers taken from Chase's denim jacket the night he died and held it against the red hat.
They look exactly the same. Same color, same size and thickness,
Joe said as both men studied the hat and sample.
They do. Both of them have fuzzy beige wool mixed in with the red.
Man, this could be it.
We'll have to send the hat to the lab, of course. But if these fibers match, we'll bring her in for questioning. Bag and label the hat.
After 4 hours of searching, the men met in the kitchen. Stretching his back, Ed said,
I reckon if there's anything else, we would have found it by now. We can always come back. Call it a day.
Maneuvering the ruts back to town, Joe said,
Seems like if she's guilty of this thing, she would have hidden the red cap, not just hung it in the open like that.
She probably had no idea fibers would fall off the hat onto his jacket, or that the lab could identify them. She just wouldn't know something like that.
Well, she might not have known that, but I bet she knows a bunch. Those male peacocks strutting around, competing so much for sex they can't hardly fly. I ain't sure what it all means, but it adds up to something.
Chapter 35. The Compass. 1969. One July afternoon in 1969, more than 7 months after Jody's visit, The Eastern Seacoast Birds by Catherine Danielle Clark, her second book, a volume of stark detail and beauty, appeared in her mailbox. She ran her fingers over the striking jacket, her painting of a herring gull. Smiling, she said,
"Hey, Big Red, you made it to the cover."
Carrying the new book, Kaya walked silently to the shady oak clearing near her shack, searching for mushrooms. The moist duff felt cool on her feet as she neared a cluster of intensely yellow toadstools. Mid-stride, she halted. There, sitting on the old feather stump, was a small milk carton, red and white, just like the one from so long ago. Unexpectedly, she laughed out loud. Inside the carton, wrapped in tissue paper, was an old army-issue compass in a brass case, tarnished green-gray with age. She breathed in at the sight of it. She had never needed a compass because the directions seemed obvious to her. But on cloudy days, when the sun was elusive, the compass would guide her. A folded note read, "Dearest Kaya, this compass was my grandpa's from the First World War. He gave it to me when I was little, but I've never used it, and I thought maybe you would get the best out of it. Love, Tate. P.S. I'm glad you can read this note." Kaya read the words, "Dearest" and "Love" again. Tate. The golden-haired boy in the boat, guiding her home before a storm, gifting her feathers on a weathered stump, teaching her to read. The tender teenager steering her through her first cycle as a woman and arousing her first sexual desires as a female. The young scientist encouraging her to publish her books. Despite gifting him the shell book, she had continued to hide in the undergrowth when she saw him in the marsh, rowing away unseen. The dishonest signals of fireflies, all she knew of love. Even Jody had said she should give Tate another chance. But every time she thought of him or saw him, her heart jumped from the old love to the pain of abandonment. She wished it would settle on one side or the other. Several mornings later, she slipped through the estuaries in an early fog, the compass tucked in her knapsack, though she would not likely need it. She planned to search for rare wildflowers on a wooded tongue of sand that jutted into the sea, but part of her scanned the waterways for Tate's boat. The fog turned stubborn and lingered, twisting its tendrils around tree snags and low-lying limbs. The air was still. Even the birds were quiet as she eased forward through the channel. Nearby, a clonk-clonk sounded as a slow-moving oar trapped a gunwale, and then a boat emerged, ghoul-like, from the haze. Colors, which had been muted by the dimness, formed into shapes as they moved into the light. Golden hair beneath a red cap, as if coming in from a dream, Tate stood in the stern of his old fishing boat pulling through the channel. Kaya cut her engine and rowed backward into a thicket to watch him pass. Always backward to watch him pass. At sundown, calmer, heart back in place, Kaya stood on the beach and recited, "Sunsets are never simple. Twilight is refracted and reflected, but never true. Eventide is a disguise, covering tracks, covering lies. We don't care that dusk deceives. We see brilliant colors and never learn the sun has dropped beneath the earth by the time we see the burn. Sunsets are in disguise, covering truths, covering lies. A.H. Chapter 36, To Trap a Fox, 1969. Joe walked through the opened door of the sheriff's office.
Okay, got the report. Let's have a look.
Both men scanned quickly to the last page. Ed said,
That's it. A perfect match. Fibers from her hat were on Chase's jacket as he lay dead.
The sheriff slapped the report across his wrist, then continued.
Let's review what we have here. Number one, the shrimper will testify that he saw Miss Clark boating toward the fire tower just before Chase fell to his death. His colleague will back him up. Two, Patty Love said Miss Clark made the shell necklace for Chase, and it disappeared the night he died. Three, fibers from her hat were on his jacket. Four, motive. The woman wronged. And an alibi we can refute. That should do it.
A better motive might help, Joe said. Being jilted doesn't seem like enough.
It's not like we're finished with the investigation, but we have enough to bring her in for questioning. Probably enough to charge her. We'll see how it goes once we get her here.
Well, that's the problem, isn't it?
How? She's outrun everybody for years. Truant officers, census takers, you name it. She's outwit them all, including us. We go out there chasing her through swamp grass, we'll make fools of ourselves. I'm not afraid of that. Just because nobody else could catch her doesn't mean we can't. But that wouldn't be the smartest way of doing it. I say we set a trap.
Oh, yeah. Well, the deputy said, I know a thing or two about trapping. And when you go to trap a fox, it's usually the trap that gets foxed.
It's not like we have surprise on our side. We've been out there knocking on her door enough to scare off a brown bear.
What about the hounds? That'd be a sure thing.
The sheriff was silent a few seconds.
I don't know. Maybe I'm getting old and soft at the grand old age of 51, but running down a woman with hounds for questioning doesn't seem right. It's fine for escaped convicts, people already convicted of some crime, but like everybody else, she's innocent until proven guilty, and I can't see setting hounds on a female suspect. Maybe as a last resort, but not yet.
Okay, what kind of trap?
That's what we got to figure out.
On December 15th, as Ed and Joe discussed options of how to bring Kaya in, someone knocked on the door. The large form of a man loomed behind the frosted glass.
Come on in, the sheriff called.
As the man stepped inside, Ed said,
Well, hello, Rodney. What can we do for you?
Rodney Horn, a retired mechanic, spent most of his days fishing with his pal Denny Smith. The villagers knew him as quiet and settled, always in bib overalls, never missed church, but wore his overalls there as well, with a nice fresh shirt ironed and starched stiff as a plank by his wife Elsie. Rodney took off his felt hat and held it in front of his belly. Ed offered him a chair, but Rodney shook his head.
This won't take long, he said. Just something might be relevant to the Chase Andrews thing.
What you got? Joe asked.
Well, it was a while back now. Me and Denny were out fishing on August 30th this year, and we seen something out at Cypress Cove. Think it might be of interest to you.
Go ahead, the sheriff said. But please, sit down, Rodney. We'd all feel more comfortable if you sat.
Rodney took the chair offered and for the next 5 minutes told them his story. After he left, Ed and Joe looked at each other. Joe said,
Well, now we've got motive. Let's get her in here.
Chapter 37, Gray Sharks, 1969. Just days before Christmas, and earlier in the morning than usual, Kaya motored slowly and quietly toward Jumpin's. Ever since the sheriff or his deputy had been sneaking out to her place, trying to catch her at home, failed efforts she'd observed from the palmettos, she'd bought her gas and supplies before first light, when only fishermen were about. Now, low clouds scudded just above a sloshing sea, and to the east, a squall, twisted tightly like a whip, threatened from the horizon. She'd have to finish at Jumpin's quickly and get home before it hit. From a quarter of a mile out, she saw his wharf billowed in with fog. She slowed even more and looked around for other boats in the soggy quiet. Finally, at about 40 yards out, she could see Jumpin's form in the old chair leaning against the wall. She waved. He did not. He did not stand. He shook his head slightly, just a whisper. She let go of the throttle. She waved again. Jumpin stared at her, but did not move. Jerking the stick, she turned abruptly back toward the sea. But coming in from the fog was a large boat, the sheriff at the helm, another couple of boats flanking, and just behind them, the squall. Gunning her engine, she threaded the needle between the oncoming rigs, her boat banging white caps as she raced for the open sea. She wanted to cut back toward the marsh, but the sheriff was too close. He'd catch her before she got there. The sea no longer swelled in symmetrical waves, but tossed in confusion. The water grew meaner as the edge of the storm engulfed her. In seconds, it released a torrent. She was soaked through, long strands of hair stringing across her face. She turned into the wind to keep from capsizing, but the sea pushed over the bow. Knowing their boats were faster, she hunched forward into the ragged wind. Maybe she could lose them in this soup or dive into the sea and make a swim for it. Her mind raced through the details of jumping in, which seemed her best chance. This close to shore, there'd be a backwash or rip, which would zip her along underwater much faster than they'd think she could swim. Popping up to breathe now and then, she could get to land and sneak out on a brushy shore. Behind her, their motors raced louder than the storm, getting closer. How could she simply stop? She'd never given up. She had to jump now. But suddenly, like gray sharks, they massed around her, pulling close. One of the boats whipped in front of her and she rammed its side. Thrown back against the outboard, her neck jerked. The sheriff reached out and grabbed her gunwale, all of them wallowing in the churning wakes. Two men swung into her boat as the deputy said, "Miss Catherine Clark, you're under arrest for the murder of Mr. Chase Andrews. You have the right to remain silent." She didn't hear the rest of it. No one hears the rest of it. Chapter 38, Sunday Justice, 1970. Kaya's eyes blinked shut against sharp light that poured from overhead lamps and windows as tall as the ceiling. For 2 months, she'd lived in dimness, and now, opening her eyes again, caught a soft edge of the marsh outside. Rounded oaks sheltering scrub-sized ferns and winter holly. She tried to hold the vital green a second longer, but was led by firm hands toward a long table and chairs where her attorney, Tom Milton, sat. Her wrists were cuffed in front, forcing her hands into an awkward prayer pose. Dressed in black slacks and a plain white blouse, with a single braid falling between her shoulder blades, she didn't turn her head to look at the spectators. Still, she felt the heat and rustle of people knotted into the courtroom for her murder trial, could sense people's shoulders and heads waggling to catch a glimpse of her, to see her in handcuffs. A smell of sweat, old smoke, and cheap perfume increased her nausea. Coughing noises ceased, but the hubbub rose as she neared her seat. All distant sounds to her, because mostly she heard the sickness of her own jagged breathing. She stared at the floorboards, highly polished heart pine, while the cuffs were removed, and then sat heavy into the chair. It was 9:30 a.m. on February 25th, 1970. Tom leaned close to her and whispered that everything would be all right. She said nothing, but searched his eyes for sincerity, anything to hang on. Not that she believed him, but for the first time ever, she had to put herself in the charge of another. Rather tall for 71 years, he wore his thick white hair and frumpy linen suits with the accidental, if cliched, grace of a country statesman. He moved gently and spoke quietly behind a pleasant smile that lived on his face. Judge Sims had appointed a young attorney for Miss Clark, since she had taken no action to do so herself. But when Tom Milton heard of this, he came out of retirement and requested to represent her pro bono. Like everyone else, he had heard stories about the Marsh girl, and over the years had seen her occasionally, either drifting sleekly through waterways as part of the current, or scurrying from the grocery like a coon from a rubbish bin. When he first visited Kaya in jail 2 months ago, he'd been led into a small dark room where she sat at a table. She had not looked up at him. Tom had introduced himself, saying he would represent her, but she didn't speak or raise her eyes. He had an overpowering urge to reach out and pat her hand, but something, maybe her upright posture or the way she stared, vacant-eyed, shielded her from touch. Moving his head at different angles, trying to capture her eyes, he explained the court procedures, what she should expect, and then asked her some questions. But she never answered, never moved, and never looked at him. As they led her from the room, she turned her head and glimpsed through a small window where she could see the sky. Seabirds shrieked over the town harbor, and Kaya seemed to be watching their songs. On his next visit, Tom reached into a brown paper bag and slid a glossy coffee table book toward her. Titled The Rarest Shells of the World, it opened to life-sized oil paintings of shells from the most distant shores on Earth. Her mouth partly open, she turned slowly through the pages, nodding at particular specimens. He gave her time. Then, once again, he spoke to her. And this time she looked into his eyes. With easy patience, he explained the court procedures and even drew a picture of the courtroom, showing the jury box, the judge's bench, where the attorneys and she would sit. Then he added stick figures of the bailiff, the judge, and the recorder and explained their roles. As on the first meeting, he tried to explain the evidence against her and to ask about her whereabouts on the night Chase died, but she pulled back into her shell at any mention of details. Later, when he stood to leave, she slid the book back across the table, but he said,
"No, I brought it for you. It's yours."
She bit her lips and blinked. And now, in the courtroom for the first time, he tried to distract her from the bustle behind them by pointing out the features of the courtroom in the drawing. But diversion was useless. By 9:45 a.m., the gallery overflowed with villagers filling every pew and buzzed with high-pitched comments about the evidence, the death penalty. A small balcony at the rear seated 20 more, and though not marked, everybody understood colored people were restricted to the balcony. Today it was filled mostly with whites, with only a few blacks, this being a white case through and through. Sectioned off near the front sat a few journalists from the Atlanta Constitution and the Raleigh Herald. People who couldn't find seats bunched along the back wall and along the sides by the tall windows, fidgeting, muttering, gossiping. The Marsh girl put up for murder. It didn't get any better than this. Sunday Justice, the courthouse cat, his back black, his face white with a black mask around green eyes, stretched out in a puddle of sunlight in one of the deep window sills. A courthouse fixture for years, he cleared the basement of rats and the courtroom of mice, earning his place. Because Barkley Cove was the first village settled in this torn and marshy stretch of the North Carolina coast, the Crown had declared it the county seat and built the original courthouse in 1754. Later, even though other towns, such as Sea Oaks, became more populated and developed, Barkley Cove remained the official hub for county government. Lightning struck the original courthouse in 1912, burning much of the wooden structure to ashes. Rebuilt the next year on the same square at the end of Main Street, it was a brick two-story with 12-foot windows trimmed in granite. By the 1960s, wild grasses and palmettos and even a few cattails had moved in from the marsh and taken over the once-groomed grounds. A lily-choked lagoon flooded in spring, and over the years had eaten part of the sidewalk. In contrast, the courtroom itself, designed to replicate the original, was imposing. The elevated judge's bench, made of dark mahogany with a colorful inlay of the state seal, stood under multiple flags, including the Confederate. The half wall of the jury box, also of mahogany, was trimmed in red cedar, and the windows that lined one side of the room framed the sea. As the officials entered the courtroom, Tom pointed to the stick figures in his drawing and explained who they were.
"That's the bailiff, Hank Jones,"
he said, as a lanky man of 60 with a hairline that receded past his ears, making his head almost exactly half bald and half not, walked to the front of the room. He wore a gray uniform and a wide belt, hung with a radio, a flashlight, an impressive set of keys, and a holstered Colt six-shooter. Mr. Jones called out to the crowd,
"Sorry, folks, but you all know the fire marshal's rules. If you don't have a seat, you got to leave."
"That's Miss Henrietta Jones, the bailiff's daughter, the court recorder,"
Tom explained, as a young woman, as tall and thin as her father, walked in quietly and sat at a desk near the judge's bench. Already seated, the prosecuting attorney, Mr. Eric Chastain, unpacked notepads from his briefcase. Eric, a broad-chested, red-headed man of nearly 6 feet, dressed in blue suits and wide, bright ties, purchased at Sears Roebuck in Asheville. Bailiff Jones called,
"All rise. This court is in session. The Honorable Judge Harold Sims presiding."
Sudden silence fell. The chamber door opened, and Judge Sims entered and nodded for everyone to sit, and asked both the prosecuting and defense attorneys to approach the bench. A large boned man with a round face and bold white sideburns, he lived in Sea Oaks, but had officiated over Barkley Cove cases for 9 years. He was generally considered to be a no-nonsense, level-headed, and fair arbitrator. His voice boomed across the room.
"Mr. Milton, your motion to relocate this trial to another county on the grounds that Miss Clark cannot get a fair trial due to prejudices against her in this community is denied. I accept that she has lived in unusual circumstances and been subjected to some prejudice, but I see no evidence that she has endured more prejudices than many people on trial in small towns all across this nation, and some large towns, for that matter. We will proceed here and now."
Nods of approval eased through the room as the attorneys returned to their seats. He continued,
"Catherine Danielle Clark of Barkley County, North Carolina, you are charged with murder in the first degree of Chase Lawrence Andrews, formerly of Barkley Cove. First-degree murder is defined as a premeditated act, and in such cases, the state is allowed to seek the death penalty. The prosecutor has announced that they will do so if you are found guilty."
The room murmured. Tom seemed to have inched slightly closer to Kaya, and she didn't deny herself that comfort.
We will begin the jury selection.
Judge Sims turned toward the first two rows filled with potential jurors. As he read off a list of rules and conditions, Sunday Justice jumped down from the windowsill with a thud and in one fluid motion leapt onto the judge's bench. Absent-mindedly, Judge Sims stroked the cat's head as he continued.
In capital cases, the state of North Carolina allows a juror to be excused if he or she does not believe in the death penalty. Please raise your hand if you will not or cannot impose the death sentence if a guilty verdict is delivered.
No hands were raised. Death penalty was all Kaya heard. The judge continued.
Another legitimate reason to be excused from the jury is if you have now or had in the past such a close relationship with either Miss Clark or Mr. Andrews that you cannot be objective in this case. Please let me know now if you feel this is true.
From the middle of the second row, Mrs. Sally Culpepper lifted her hand and stated her name. Her gray hair was pulled back severely in a tiny knot, and her hat, suit, and shoes bore the same dull brown.
All right, Sally, tell me what's on your mind, the judge said.
As you know, I was the truant officer for Barclay County for nearly 25 years. Miss Clark was one of my cases, and so I had some dealings with her, or tried to.
Kaya couldn't see Mrs. Culpepper or anyone in the main gallery unless she turned around, which, of course, she'd never do. But she remembered clearly the last time Mrs. Culpepper sat in the car while the man in the fedora tried to chase her down. Kaya had been as easy on the old man as she could, taking off noisily through brambles to give him a clue, then circling back and hiding in some bushes next to the car. But Fedora ran in the opposite direction toward the beach. Crouching there, Kaya shook a holly branch against the door, and Mrs. Culpepper looked out the window directly into her eyes. She thought at the time that the truant lady smiled slightly. In any case, she made no attempt to give her away when Fedora returned, cussing up a streak, then driving down the road for good. Now, Mrs. Culpepper said to the judge,
Well, since I had dealings with her, I don't know if that means I should be excused.
Judge Sims said,
Thank you, Sally. Some of you may have dealt with Miss Clark in the shops or in official ways, as in Miss Culpepper's case, the truant officer. The point is, can you listen to the testimony given here and decide whether she's guilty or innocent based on the evidence, not on past experience or feelings?
Yes, sir, I'm sure I can do that, Your Honor.
Thank you, Sally. You can stay.
By 11:30, seven women and five men sat in the jury box. From there, Kaya could see them and stole glances at their faces. Most of them she recognized from the village, though she knew few of the names. Mrs. Culpepper sat squarely in the middle and gave slight comfort to Kaya, but next to her sat Teresa White, blonde wife of the Methodist preacher who years ago had rushed from the shoe shop to whisk her daughter away from Kaya as she stood on the curb after having lunch in the diner with Pa. That one and only time. Mrs. White, who had told her daughter that Kaya was dirty, now sat on the jury. Judge Sims called for a lunch recess until 1 p.m. The diner would bring over tuna fish, chicken salad, and ham sandwiches for the jurors, who would eat in the deliberation room. To be fair to the town's two eating establishments, the doggone beer hall would deliver hot dogs, chili, and shrimp po'boys on alternative days. They always brought something for the cat, too. Sunday Justice preferred the po' boys. Chapter 39 Chase by Chance, 1969. A fog was lifting from an August morning in 1969 as Kaya motored to a remote peninsula the locals called Cypress Cove, where she had once seen rare toadstools. August was late for mushrooms, but Cypress Cove was cool and moist, so perhaps she could find the rare species again. More than a month had passed since Tate had left the compass for her on the feather stump, and though she'd seen him in the marsh, she hadn't ventured close enough to thank him for the gift. Neither had she used the compass, though it was tucked safely in one of the many pockets of her knapsack. Moss-draped trees hugged the bank, and their low-hanging limbs formed a cave close to the shore through which she glided, searching the thickets for small orange mushrooms on slender stalks. And finally she saw them, bold and brilliant, clinging to the sides of an old stump, and after beaching her boat, sat cross-legged in the cove, drawing them. Suddenly, she heard footsteps on the duff, and then a voice.
"Well, look who's here. My marsh girl."
Whirling around, standing at the same time, she stood face to face with Chase.
"Hello, Kaya,"
he said. She looked around. How had he gotten here? She'd heard no boat. He read her question.
"I was fishing, saw you pass, so landed over yonder on the other side."
"Please just go,"
she said, stuffing her pencils and pad in the knapsack. But he put his hand on her arm.
"Come on, Kaya. I'm sorry about how things turned out."
He leaned in, wisps of breakfast bourbon on his breath.
"Don't touch me."
"Hey, I said I'm sorry. You knew we couldn't get married. You never could have lived near town. But I always cared about you. I stayed by you."
"Stayed by me?
What does that mean? Leave me alone."
Kaya tucked the knapsack under her arm and walked toward the boat, but he grabbed her arm, holding hard.
"Kaya, there'll never be anybody else like you, never. And I know you love me."
She ripped her arm from his hands.
"You're wrong. I'm not sure I ever loved you. But you talked to me about marriage, remember? You talked about building a house for you and me. Instead, I found out about your engagement to somebody else in the newspaper. Why'd you do that? Why, Chase?"
"Come on, Kaya. It was impossible. You must have known it wouldn't work. What's wrong with how things were? Let's go back to what we had."
He reached for her shoulders and pulled her toward him.
"Let go of me!"
She twisted, tried to yank away, but he gripped her with both hands, hurting her arms. He put his mouth on hers and kissed her. She threw her arms up, knocking his hands away. She pulled her head back, hissing,
"Don't you dare!"
"There's my lynx, wilder than ever."
Grabbing her shoulders, he clipped the back of her knees with one of his legs and pushed her to the ground. Her head bounced hard on the dirt.
"I know you want me,"
he said, leering.
"No, stop,"
she screamed. Kneeling, he jammed his knee in her stomach, knocking the breath from her, as he unzipped his jeans and pulled them down. She reared up, pushing him with both hands. Suddenly, he slugged her face with his right fist. A sick popping sound rang out inside her head. Her neck snapped back, and her body was thrown backward onto the ground, just like Pa hitting Ma. Her mind blanked for seconds against a pounding pain. Then she twisted and turned, trying to squirm out from under him, but he was too strong. Holding both her arms over her head with one hand, he unzipped her shorts and ripped down her panties as she kicked at him. She screamed, but there was no one to hear. Kicking at the ground, she struggled to free herself, but he grabbed her waist and flipped her over onto her stomach, shoved her throbbing face into the dirt, then reached under her belly and pulled her pelvis up to him as he knelt behind.
"I'm not letting you go this time. Like it or not, you're mine."
Finding strength from somewhere primal, she pushed against the ground with her knees and arms and reared up, at the same time swinging her elbow back across his jaw. As his head swung to the side, she struck him wildly with her fists until he lost his balance and sprawled backward onto the dirt. Then, taking aim, she kicked him in his groin, square and solid. He bent double and rolled on his side, holding his testicles and writhing. For good measure, she kicked him in the back, knowing exactly where his kidneys lay, several times, hard. Pulling up her shorts, she grabbed the knapsack and ran to her boat. Snapping the starter rope, she looked back as he rose to his hands and knees, moaning. She cussed until the motor cranked. Expecting him to chase after her any second, she turned the tiller sharply and accelerated away from the bank just as he stood. Her hands shaking, she zipped up her pants and held her body tight with one arm. Wild-eyed, she looked out to sea and saw another fishing rig nearby, two men staring at her. Chapter 40, Cypress Cove, 1970. After lunch, Judge Sims asked the prosecutor,
"Eric, are you ready to call your first witness?" "We are, Your Honor."
In former murder cases, Eric usually called the coroner first, because his testimony introduced material evidence such as the murder weapon, time and place of death, and crime scene photographs, all of which made sharp impressions on the jurors. But in this case, there was no murder weapon, no fingerprints or footprints, so Eric intended to begin with motive.
"Your Honor, the people call Mr. Rodney Horn."
Everyone in court watched Rodney Horn step onto the witness stand and swear to tell the truth. Kaya recognized his face, even though she'd seen it for only a few seconds. She turned away. A retired mechanic, he was one of them, spending most of his days fishing, hunting, or playing poker at the Swamp Guinea. Could hold his liquor like a rain barrel. Today, as ever, he wore his denim bib overalls with a clean plaid shirt, starched so stiff the collar stood at attention. He held his fishing cap in his left hand as he was sworn in with the right, then sat down in the witness box, hat on his knee. Eric stepped casually to the witness stand.
"Good morning, Rodney."
"Morning, Eric."
"Now, Rodney, I believe you were fishing with a friend near Cypress Cove on the morning of August 30th, 1969. Is that correct?"
"That's exactly right. Me and Denny were out there fishing. Been there since dawn."
"For the record, that would be Denny Smith."
"Yeah, me and Denny."
"All right. I would like you to tell the court what you saw that morning."
"Well, like I said, we'd been there since dawn, and it was near 11, I reckon, and hadn't had a nibble for some time, so we was about to pull our lines and head out, when we heard a commotion in the trees over on the point, in the woods."
"What kind of commotion?"
"Well, there was voices, kind of muffled at first, then louder. A man and a woman. But we couldn't see him, just heard them like they was fussing."
"Then what happened?"
"Well, the woman started hollering, so we boated over to get a better look, see if she was in trouble."
"And what did you see?"
"Well, by the time we got closer, we seen the woman was standing next to the man and was kicking him right in the—"
Rodney looked at the judge. Judge Sims said,
"Where did she kick him? You can say it."
"She kicked him right in the balls, and he slumped over on his side, moaning and groaning. Then she kicked him again and again in his back, mad as a mule chewing bumblebees."
"Did you recognize the woman? Is she in the courtroom today?"
"Yeah, we knew her all right. It's that one there, the defendant. The one folks call the Marsh Girl."
Judge Sims leaned toward the witness.
"Mr. Horn, the defendant's name is Miss Clark. Do not refer to her by any other name."
"All right, then. It was Miss Clark we seen.
Eric continued.
Did you recognize the man she was kicking?
Well, we couldn't see him then, because he was writhing and wiggling around on the ground. But a few minutes later, he stood up, and it was Chase Andrews, the quarterback a few years back.
And then what happened?
She came stumbling out toward her boat, and well, she was partway undressed, her shorts round her ankles and her knickers round her knees. She was trying to pull up her shorts and run at the same time, the whole time shouting at him. She went to her boat, jumped in, and zoomed away, still pulling at her pants. When she passed us by, she looked at us right in the eyes. That's how I know exactly who it was.
You said she was shouting at him the entire time she was running toward her boat. Did you hear exactly what she said?
Yeah, we could hear her plain as day by then, because we were pretty close.
Please tell the court what you heard her shout.
She was screaming, "Leave me alone, you bastard. You bother me again, I'll kill you."
A loud murmur shot through the courtroom and didn't stop. Judge Sims banged his gavel.
"That's it. That'll do it,"
Eric said to his witness.
"That will be all. Thank you, Rodney. No further questions. Your witness."
Tom brushed past Eric and stepped to the witness stand.
"Now, Rodney, you testified that at first, when you heard those muffled but loud voices, you couldn't see what was going on between Miss Clark and Mr. Andrews. Is that correct?"
"That's right. We couldn't see him till we moved up some."
"And you said the woman, who you later identified as Miss Clark, was hollering as if she was in trouble, correct?"
"Yeah."
"You didn't see any kissing or any sexual behavior between two consenting adults. You heard a woman shouting like she was being attacked as if she was in trouble. Isn't that correct?"
"Yeah."
"So isn't it possible that when Miss Clark kicked Mr. Andrews, she was defending herself, a woman alone in the woods against a very strong, athletic man, a former quarterback who had attacked her?"
"Yeah, I reckon that's possible."
"No further questions."
"Redirect?"
"Yes, Your Honor," Eric said, standing at the prosecution table.
"So, Rodney, no matter whether certain behavior was consensual or not between the two of them, is it accurate to say that the defendant, Miss Clark, was extremely mad at the deceased, Chase Andrews?"
"Yeah, plenty mad."
"Mad enough to scream that if he bothered her again, she would kill him. Isn't that correct?"
"Yeah, that's how it was."
"No further questions, Your Honor."
Chapter 41. A Small Herd. 1969. Kaya's hands fumbled at the tiller as she looked back to see if Chase was following in his boat from Cypress Cove. She motored fast to her lagoon and limp ran to the shack on swelling knees. In the kitchen, she dropped to the floor, crying, touching her swollen eye and spitting grit from her mouth, then listened for sounds of him coming. She had seen the shell necklace. He still wore it. How could that be?
"You're mine,"
he'd said. He'd be mad as hell that she kicked him, and he'd come for her. He might come today, or wait for night. She couldn't tell anybody. Jumpin' would insist they call in the sheriff, but the law would never believe the Marsh girl over Chase Andrews. She wasn't sure what the two fishermen had seen, but they'd never defend her. They'd say she had it coming because before Chase left her, she'd been seen smooching with him for years, behaving unladylike. "Actin' the hoe," they'd say. Outside, the wind howled from the sea and she worried that she'd never hear his motor coming. So moving slowly from the pain, She packed biscuits, cheese, and nuts in her knapsack, and head low against a manic gale, hurried through cord grass along channels toward the reading cabin. The walk took 45 minutes, and at every sound, her sore and stiff body flinched and her head jerked to the side, scanning the undergrowth. Finally, the old log structure, up to its knees in tall grasses and clinging to the creek bank, whispered into view. Here the wind was calmer, the soft meadow quiet. She'd never told Chase about her hideout, but he might have known about it. She wasn't sure. The pack rat smell was gone. After the ecology lab hired Tate, he and Scupper fixed up the old cabin so he could stay overnight on some of his expeditions. They had shored up the walls, straightened the roof, and brought in basic furniture. A small quilt-covered bed, a cook stove, a table and chair. Pots and pans hung from the rafters. Then, out of place and plastic-covered, a microscope sat on a folding table. In the corner, an old metal trunk stored tins of baked beans, sardines. Nothing to bring the bears in. But inside, she felt trapped, unable to see if Chase was coming. So she sat on the edge of the creek, searching the grassy waterland with her right eye. The left was swollen shut. Downstream, a herd of 5 female deer ignored her and wandered along the water's edge, nibbling leaves. If only she could join in, belong to them. Kaya knew it wasn't so much that the herd would be incomplete without one of its deer, but that each deer would be incomplete without her herd. One lifted her head, dark eyes searching north into the trees, stomping her right front foot. Then the left. The others looked up, then whistled in alarm. Instantly, Kaya's good eye probed the forest for signs of Chase or some other predator. But all was quiet. Perhaps the breeze had startled them. They stopped stomping, but slowly moved away into the tall grass, leaving Kaya alone and uneasy. She scanned the meadow again for intruders. But the listening and searching sucked all her energy, so she went back into the cabin, dug sweaty cheese from her bag, then slumped on the floor and ate mindlessly, touching her bruised cheek. Her face, arms, and legs were cut and smeared with bloody grit, knees scratched and throbbing. She sobbed, fighting shame, suddenly spitting the cheese out in a chunky wet spray. She'd brought this on herself. Consorting, unchaperoned. A natural wanting had led her unmarried to a cheap hotel, but still unsatisfied. Sex under flashing neon lights, marked only by blood smudged across the sheets like animal tracks. Chase had probably bragged about their doings to everyone. No wonder people shunned her. She was unfit. Disgusting. As the half moon appeared between fast-moving clouds, she searched through the small window for man-like forms, hunched and sneaking. Finally, she crawled into Tate's bed and slept under his quilt, waking often, listening for footsteps, then pulling the soft fabric closely around her face. More crumbling cheese for breakfast. Her face darkened to green-purple now, eye swollen like a boiled egg, neck stove up. Parts of her upper lip twisted grotesquely. Like Ma, monstrous, afraid to go home. In sudden clarity, Kaya saw what Ma had endured and why she left. "Ma, Ma," she whispered. "I see. Finally, I understand why you had to leave and never come back. I'm sorry I didn't know that I couldn't help you." Kaya dropped her head and sobbed, then jerked her head up and said, "I will never live like that. A life wondering when and where the next fist will fall." She hiked home that afternoon. But even though she was hungry and needed supplies, she didn't go to Jumpin's. Chase might see her there. Besides, she didn't want anyone, especially Jumpin', to see her battered face. After a simple meal of hard bread and smoked fish, she sat on the edge of her porch bed, staring through the screen. Just at that moment, she noticed a female praying mantis stalking along a branch near her face. The insect was plucking moths with her articulated forelegs, then chewing them up, their wings still flapping in her mouth. A male mantis, head high and proud as a pony, paraded along to quarter. She appeared interested, her antennae flailing about like wands. His embrace might have been tight or tender, Kaya couldn't tell, but while he probed about with his copulatory organ to fertilize her eggs, the female turned back her long, elegant neck and bit off his head. He was so busy humping, he didn't notice. His neck stump waved about as he continued his business, and she nibbled on his thorax, and then his wings. Finally, his last foreleg protruded from her mouth as his headless, heartless lower body copulated in perfect rhyme. Female fireflies draw in strange males with dishonest signals and eat them. Mantis females devour their own mates. Female insects, Kaya thought, know how to deal with their lovers. After a few days, she boated into the marsh, exploring areas Chase wouldn't know, but was jumpy and alert, making it difficult to paint. Her eye was still puffed around a thin slit, and the bruise had leached its nauseated colors across half her face. Much of her body throbbed with pain. At the chirp of a chipmunk, she whirled around, listened keenly to the caws of crows, a language before words were, when communication was simple and clear. And wherever she went, mapped an escape route in her mind. Chapter 42. A Cell, 1970. Murky shafts of light streamed through the tiny window of Kaya's cell. She stared at dust motes, dancing silently in one direction as though following some dreamy leader. When they hit the shadows, they vanished. Without the sun, they were nothing. She pulled the wooden crate, her only table, under the window, which was 7 feet above the floor. Dressed in a gray jumpsuit with County Inmate printed on the back, she stood on the crate and stared at the sea, just visible beyond the thick glass and bars. White caps slapped and spat, and pelicans, heads turning for fish, flew low over the waves. If she stretched her neck far to the right, she could see the dense crown of the marsh's edge. Yesterday, she had seen an eagle dive and twist toward a fish. The county jail consisted of 6 12-by-12 cells in a cement block one-story building behind the sheriff's office at the edge of town. The cells were in a row down the length of the building, only on one side, so inmates couldn't see one another. Three of the walls were damp cement blocks. The fourth was made of bars, including the locked door. Each cell had a wooden bed with a bumpy cotton mattress, a feather pillow, sheets, one gray wool blanket, a sink, and a wooden crepe table, plus a toilet. Over the sink was not a mirror, but a picture of Jesus, framed there by the ladies' Baptist auxiliary. The only allowance made for her, the first female inmate, other than overnighters, in years, was a gray plastic curtain that could be pulled around the sink and toilet. For 2 months before the trial, she'd been held in this cell without bail because of her failed attempt to escape the sheriff in her boat. Kaya wondered who started using the word cell instead of cage. There must have been a moment in time when humanity demanded this shift. Self-scratched red webbing streaked her arms. For untracked minutes, sitting on her bed, she studied strands of her hair, plucking them like feathers, as the gulls do. Standing on the crate, craning her neck toward the marsh. She recalled an Amanda Hamilton poem. Broken gull of Brandon Beach. Winged soul, you dance the skies and startled dawn with shrilling cries. You followed sails and braved the sea, then caught the wind back to me. You broke your wing, it dragged the land and etched your mark upon the sand. When feathers break, you cannot fly. But who decides the time to die? You disappeared, I know not where, but your wing marks still linger there. A broken heart cannot fly, but who decides the time to die? Even though the inmates couldn't see one another, the only other occupants, two men at the far end of the row, spent much of each day and evening jabbering. Both were doing 30 days for starting a fight, which ended in broken bar mirrors and a few bones, over who could spit the farthest at the doggone beer hall. Mostly they lay on their beds, calling to each other from their adjoining cells, sounding like drum squatters. Much of the banter was gossip they'd heard about Kaya's case from their visitors, especially her odds of getting the death penalty, which had not been issued in the county for 20 years, and never to a woman. Kaya heard every word. Being dead didn't bother her. They couldn't scare her with threats of ending this shadow life. But the process of being killed by another's hand, planned out and set to schedule, was so unthinkable it stopped her breath. Sleep avoided her, slinking around the edges, then darting away. Her mind would plunge along deep walls of sudden slumber, an instant of bliss, then her body would shudder her awake. She stepped down from the crate and sat on the bed, knees tucked under her chin. They'd brought her here after court, so it might be 6 by now. Only 1 hour passed. Or maybe not even that. Chapter 43. A Microscope. 1969. In early September, more than a week after Chase attacked her, she walked down her beach. The wind ripped at a letter in her hand, so she held it against her breasts. Her editor had invited her to meet him in Greenville, writing that he understood she didn't come to town often, but he wanted to meet her, and the publisher would pay her expenses. The day stood clear and hot, so she motored into the marsh. At the end of a narrow estuary, she rounded a grassy bend and saw Tate squatting on a wide sandbar, dipping up water samples in little vials. His cruiser Coombe Research vessel was tied to a log and drifted across the channel, blocking it. She heaved on the tiller. Some of the swelling and bruising on her face had diminished, but ugly green and purple splotches still circled her eye. She panicked. She could not let Tate see her battered face and tried to turn her boat around quickly. But he looked up and waved.
"Pull in, Kaya. I've got a new microscope to show you."
This had the same effect as the truant officer calling to her about chicken pie. She slowed, but didn't answer.
"Come on. You won't believe this magnification. You can see the pseudopods on the amoebas."
She'd never seen an amoeba, certainly not its body parts. And seeing Tate again brought a peace, a calmness. Deciding that she could keep her bruised face turned away from him, she beached her boat and walked through the shallow water toward his. She wore cut-off jeans and a white t-shirt, her hair free. Standing at the top of the stern ladder, he held out his hand and she took it, looking away from him. The cruiser's soft beige blended into the marsh, and Kaya had never seen anything as fine as the teak deck and brass helm.
"Come on down," he said, stepping below into the cabin.
She scanned the captain's desk, the small kitchen outfitted better than her own, and the living area that had been converted into an onboard laboratory with multiple microscopes and racks of vials. Other instruments hummed and blinked. Tate fiddled with the largest microscope and adjusted the slide.
Here, just a minute.
He touched a drop of marsh water onto the slide, covered it with another, and focused the eyepiece. He stood.
Have a look.
Kaya leaned over gently, as if to kiss a baby. The microscope's light reflected in her dark pupils, and she drew in a breath as a Mardi Gras of costumed players pirouetted and careened into view. Unimaginable headdresses adorned astonishing bodies, so eager for more life, they frolicked as though caught in a circus tent, not a single bead of water. She put her hand on her heart.
I had no idea there were so many, and so beautiful, she said, still looking.
He identified some odd species, then stepped back, watching her.
She feels the pulse of life, he thought, because there are no layers between her and her planet.
He showed her more slides. She whispered,
It's like never having seen the stars, then suddenly seeing them.
Would you like some coffee? He asked softly.
She raised her head.
No, thank you.
Then she backed away from the microscope, moving toward the galley. Awkwardly, keeping her brown-green eye turned away. Tate was accustomed to Kaya being guarded, but her behavior seemed more distant and stranger than ever, continuously keeping her head turned at an angle.
Come on, Kaya, just have a cup of coffee.
He'd already moved into the kitchenette and poured water into a machine that dripped out a strong brew. She stood by the ladder to the deck above, and he handed her a mug, motioning for her to go up. He invited her to sit on the cushioned bench, but she stood at the stern. Cat-like, she knew the exit. The brilliant white sandbar curved away from them under sheltering oaks.
Kaya?
He started to ask a question, but when she faced him, he saw the fading bruise on her cheek.
What happened to your face?
He walked toward her, reaching to touch her cheek. She turned away.
Nothing. I ran into a door in the middle of the night.
He knew that wasn't true by the way she flung her hand to her face. Someone had hit her. Had it been Chase? Was she still seeing him, even though he was married? Tate worked his jaw. Kaya moved to put her mug down, as if she were going. He forced calm.
Have you started a new book?
I'm almost finished with the one on mushrooms. My editor's coming to Greenville sometime at the end of October and wants me to meet him there, but I'm not sure.
You should go. It'd be good to meet him. There's a bus from Barclay every day, one at night, too. It doesn't take long. 1 hour and 20 minutes, maybe, something like that.
I don't know where to buy a ticket.
The driver'll know everything. Just show up at the bus stop on Main. He'll tell you what you need to do. I think Jumpin' has a schedule tacked up in his store.
He almost mentioned that he had ridden the bus many times from Chapel Hill, but thought it better not to remind her of those days, of her waiting on a July beach. They were quiet for a while, sipping their coffee, listening to a pair of hawks whistling along the walls of a tall cloud. He hesitated to offer more coffee, knowing she would leave if he did. So he asked about her mushroom book, explained the protozoans he studied. Any bait to keep her. The afternoon light softened and a cool wind picked up. Putting the mug down again, she said,
I have to go.
I was thinking of opening some wine. Would you like some?
No, thanks.
Wait a second before you go,
Tate said as he went below to the galley and returned with a bag of leftover bread and biscuits.
Please give my regards to the gulls.
Thanks.
She climbed down the ladder. As she walked toward her boat, he called out,
Kaya, it's gotten cooler. Don't you want a jacket or something?
No, I'm fine.
Here, at least take my cap.
And he tossed a red ski cap toward her. She caught it and slung it back to him. He threw it again, farther, and she jogged across the sandbar, leaned low, and scooped it up. Laughing, she jumped into her boat, cranked the motor, and as she boated near him, pitched the hat back into his boat. He grinned, and she giggled. Then they stopped laughing and simply looked at each other as they lobbed the cap back and forth until she motored around the bend. She sat down hard on the stern seat and put her hand over her mouth.
No, she said out loud. I cannot fall for him again. I will not get hurt all over again.
Tate stayed at the stern, clenching his fists at the image of someone hitting her. She hugged the coastline just beyond the surf, heading south. On this route, she would pass her beach before reaching the channel that led through the marsh to her shack. Usually, she didn't stop at her beach, but motored through the maze of waterways to her lagoon, and then walked to the shore. But as she passed by, the gulls spotted her and swarmed the boat. Big Red landed on the bow, bobbing his head. She laughed.
Okay, then. You win.
Breaking through the surf, she beached her boat behind tall sea oats and stood at the shoreline, tossing the crumbs Tate had given her. As the sun spread golden pink across the water, she sat on the sand while the gulls settled around her. Suddenly, she heard a motor and saw Chase's ski boat racing toward her channel. He could not see her boat behind the sea oats, but she was in plain sight on the open sand. Instantly, she lay flat, turning her head to the side so she could watch him. He stood at the helm, hair blowing back, face in an ugly scowl. But he didn't look in her direction as he turned into the channel toward her shack. When he was out of sight, she sat up. If she hadn't beached here with the gulls, he would have caught her at home. She'd learned over and over from Pa. These men had to have the last punch. Kaya had left Chase sprawled on the dirt. The two old fishermen had probably seen her flatten him. As Pa would have it, Kaya had to be taught a lesson. As soon as he discovered she wasn't at the shack, he'd walk here to her beach. She ran to her boat, throttled up, and headed back toward Tate. But she didn't want to tell Tate what Chase had done to her. Shame overwhelmed reason. She slowed down and drifted on swells as the sun disappeared. She had to hide and wait for Chase to leave. If she didn't see him go, she wouldn't know when it was safe to motor home. She turned into the channel, panicked that he could roar in her direction at any second. Her motor just above idle so she could hear his boat, she eased into a backwater thicket of overhanging trees and brush. She reversed deeper into the undergrowth, pushing limbs aside until layers of leaves and the falling night hid her. Breathing hard, she listened. Finally, she heard his engine screaming across the soft evening air. She ducked lower as he approached, suddenly worried that the tip of her boat was visible. The sound came very close, and in seconds, his boat zoomed by. She sat there for nearly 30 minutes until it was truly dark, then cruised home by starlight. She took her bedding to the beach and sat with the gulls. They paid her no mind, preening outstretched wings before settling down on the sand like feathered stones. As they chortled softly and tucked their heads for the night, she lay as close to them as she could get. But even among their soft cooing and ruffling, Kaya couldn't sleep. Mostly, she tossed from one side to the other, sitting up each time the wind mimicked footfalls. Dawn surf roared on a slapping wind that stung her cheeks. She sat up among the birds, who wandered nearby, stretching and kick-scratching. Big Red, eyes wide, neck cocked, seemed to have found something most interesting in his underwing, an act that would normally have made Kaya laugh. But the birds brought her no cheer. She walked to the water's edge. Chase would not let this go. Being isolated was one thing, living in fear, quite another. She imagined taking one step after the other into the churning sea, sinking into the stillness beneath the waves, strands of her hair suspending like black watercolor into the pale blue sea, her long fingers and arms drifting up toward the backlit blaze of the surface. Dreams of escape, even through death, always lift toward the light. The dangling, shiny prize of peace just out of grasp, until finally her body descends to the bottom and settles in murky quiet. Safe. Who decides the time to die?